Today is Monday, April 26th, 2021. This is part four of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Donna Gebler, last name spelled G-E-B-L-E-R. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Donna. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm well. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you for taking the time to do this oral history. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you do.
Thank you very much. At the end of the last interview, you mentioned that you moved back to Salt Lake City in 1985 and then decided to go back to the university and get a master's degree in social work. I wondered if you could kind of explain a little bit what attracted you to social work?
Well, before we do that, I would like to go back and correct something in our interview of last week.
Yes, please.
I think I said when we left the state of Washington and went to West Virginia that my two older children were married. I'm not sure I remember that correctly, but they were not married. They were both in college.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, well, back to returning to Utah and going to the master's in social work. I had just been pondering what to do, and I was sort of sitting around needing something and felt going back to school would be a wise thing to do. And social work attracted me because I've always been interested in the human condition and had worked with people, women especially. I'm especially committed to women's issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so I applied and was accepted. And because it was so competitive, I was surprised, but I was.
Well, good for you. And what program did you apply to?
The Graduate School of Social Work. So I went for a master's in social work at the University of Utah.
Okay. Did you end up writing a thesis in that program?
No, we didn't do a thesis. We did what's called a practicum. So part of my training in social work was spending time as a volunteer. I think they call it internships now. We called it a practicum.
Mm-hmm.
Where I served in places like I was at the Women's Resource Center at the University of Utah, where I did therapy with women. I did some work with the Tooele Division of Family Services and involved group work and individual therapy with women. Did some classroom instruction when I was at the Women's Resource Center. So it was called a practicum. So you had on-site training.
Okay.
And got credit.
Nice. Yeah, good. It's basically on-the-job experience, in a way.
Yes, that's exactly what it was.
And
with supervision, so that you were always supervised and helped along the way, so you weren't out there trying to fish in deep water without a fishing pole.
Right. And being the bait.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm assuming that when you entered this program, you entered it with other students that were your daughter's age.
Yes, there was a wide variety. I was in my early 50s at that time. Yes, there was some others probably close to my age and experience, but more were younger. Of course, they were all college graduates. Probably, and some of it had some work experience in the field of social work and wanted to go on and get a higher licensure or qualification to get on with their professions.
Okay. And what was that? What was your schooling like? Was it enjoyable? Was it tough? Was it frustrating? What do you remember about it?
I loved it. At times it was challenging, but I loved it. And I'm very fond of libraries and study and learning.
Mm-hmm.
And reading. And the on-site experience sort of came very naturally. I don't find it being particularly challenging. I enjoyed it very much.
So it was. It sounds like maybe it was easy and productive.
It was productive, and there was a lot of writing of papers. I didn't mind that at all. Met some very interesting people, kind of a cross-section of people, and that was also instructive and helpful.
Like what? Can you give me an example?
Well, just students from different walks of life, some from Native American families, some from other states that came to Utah to do this.
Okay.
Different. I probably was the only, well, maybe I was the only widow in the group.
Okay. Okay. And was this a 2 or 3 year program?
It was a 2 year program.
Okay. Did you consider when you were in that program going for a PhD?
Well, I didn't at the time. Part of the goal of doing this was to get back into the workforce, in a sense, and increase my income.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the goal upon graduation. But since then, I've often wondered why I did not go back and do a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
Because I like the academic environment. Maybe the ivory tower, I don't know.
Uh-huh. Well, you certainly
you hear about that, right?
You certainly have. Oh yeah, you certainly had the skills, and you know, certainly had lots of things to bring to any organization that would be very helpful.
Thank you.
So as your 2 years came to a close, what were you sort of looking for in the job market landscape? What happened then?
Well, I was looking for just something where I could use my master's degree in social work. I didn't necessarily want to work for government. So I ended up basically because of someone I knew in a graduate school seminar working in private nonprofit work with homeless people. So I, at that time in Salt Lake City, the Travelers Aid Society was the governing or organizational society that helped with homeless in Salt Lake City. And I became the social worker for homeless families, and later in February of 89, I became director of the family shelter and of the women's shelter under Travelers Aid in Salt Lake City.
Was that a new program, the women's shelter?
Well, homelessness, what was new was the family shelter. About this time in the late 80s in Salt Lake City, there began to be an interest in not only warehousing homeless people, but providing casework and social work help for them to help them solve their problems, connect with resources, and get out of homelessness if possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so a new facility was built, and so there had been some homeless services in Salt Lake before, but it was more like warehousing, and this became a new focus on case management.
So this would be helpful. You can really help me clear up some misconceptions that I have. When I think of homelessness, I think of a couple things. One is the economy, but the other one is mental health issues.
Well,
is that correct? I mean, is that a correct assumption? And so how did you tackle this?
Well, of course, this was some years ago, and the homeless situation is more in the forefront today, I think, in most big cities. But let's go back to the late 80s and going into the 90s.
Please.
Some issues around homelessness were veterans. There was some mental health issues. There was intergenerational poverty. There was some drug issues.
Thank you. Yeah.
And then there's just also bad luck.
Uh-huh, yes.
And so all those issues existed, and of course, back then, and I think this still perhaps is in our society today, back then, if you saw a ragged person or a homeless person on the street, you'd walk to the other side of the street. You really didn't want to interact with them because you assumed automatically that they would steal from you or that they were an undesirable person. I can tell you that's really not true.
Right.
At least it wasn't then. There is some of that element there among all levels of society.
That's right. That's right.
But there's always those biases that existed. So I found out with homeless families back then that what made them homeless, of course, sometimes there was the generational poverty issue where you had just learned to use resources like food stamps or whatever entitlements you were entitled to back then. So there was some of that, but often the common denominators were lack of education and skills, and the other one was lack of support systems. Somehow you either had no support systems, you had no existing family, no really good friends, or you had done something that you had just severed those support system ties, and so mm-hmm. they weren't available to you. Those seem to be the main, lack of education was a big one. So, but yes, there was always some mental health issues that mixed in there. And there were people who just did not want services or help or wouldn't want to go into a shelter.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't like the rules. They had a dog. They couldn't bring their dog to shelter, something like that.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's a really wide variety of reasons.
It's complex. It's complex.
It is, yes.
And, of course, there's always the hard luck thing where you lost your job and it was minimal anyway and you couldn't pay the rent.
Right, which is happening today. I mean, these issues didn't just go away.
No, it's very much true today. And, of course, the person that had some skills and who had been working, usually they would accept the case management help and they would get out of homelessness and eventually get back on their feet.
Nice. Can you tell me a little bit about the family shelter? Where was it? What was it like?
Well, it was a building. I don't know that it was built. It was restructured to work as a shelter. It was on the corner of 2nd South and, well, it's in the Rio Grande area of Salt Lake City, and across the street was St. Vincent de Paul Center where they could go for meals. And so on the bottom floor was the family shelter, and on the top, there was a two-story building. On the top floor was the men's shelter.
Okay.
The women's shelter was in an old home several blocks away, but eventually they were moved into this same building on the ground floor where the families were. Also housed Travelers Aid Society, which I don't know if they're still in existence. They were a service in Salt Lake City that helped people with traveling problems, like get a bus ticket, a train ticket.
Okay.
So that would be temporary help. But the shelter was designed on a case management model so that you came into shelter and you would have a caseworker assigned to you to help you access resources and to work on getting housing.
Okay. And is that what you did? You were a case manager?
Well, I was the director, and so I directed the staff. I had caseworkers who worked under me.
Okay.
I did research. I did policy development. I did individual and group work with homeless individuals and families. And I supervised the case management.
Wow.
Got to hire and fire staff.
I can only think that case management, being a case manager, is a difficult job.
It was extremely difficult. And after a while, if you didn't take care of yourself, you often hear the statement, healer, heal yourself.
Yes.
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 And I would find if I had staff bringing bread in to give to their clients in the shelter, I was in trouble because you could get really into a rescuing mode when you're trying to help people and get very entangled in their issues and their problems. And so it's hard to maintain a level of objectivity, and you could have burnout very quickly.
What did you do to try to help your staff not get burned out?
Oh, gee whiz, that's a good question. I'm not sure I tackled that very well. We always had staff meetings. I was always in touch with what they were doing and reviewing their work. I suppose, I don't know that we addressed that well. I can't think back. Got a fuzzy head.
Mm. No, this is true for, I think it's true for anyone who has to day in, day out, deal with people in uncomfortable or painful situations, whether it's a doctor or a nurse or a front office staff in a clinic or in a homeless shelter or law enforcement, firefighters, anyone who has to deal with the difficult issues of society, whether it's social or physical or mental.
Yes, and fortunately I had people who worked for me that were well-balanced, and I think that was a big thing. We also would do little social things from time to time so that not only were we together in a work environment, we would be like in a social environment like a potluck supper or a picnic or something.
And
of course, if you're a licensed social worker, you're always trying to keep your licensure active, and so you're participating in ongoing training all the time.
Right, right. But I would think that would also fall on you as the director to hire people that you thought were stable enough to handle week in, week out, month in, month out, year in, year out, case after case after case of distress.
Yes, yes, yes. But they did it, and they did it very well.
Mm, nice, nice. And how long did you do that?
Well, I was with the family shelter until, I think, about 1994. And then I went to the Odyssey House of Utah. They were just implementing a new program for women and children, and I became the director of that program.
And what was the Odyssey House mission?
Odyssey House is a drug treatment program, and it's based on long-term, inpatient rehabilitation, and it involved a lot of group work and individual therapy. And it was also on the theory that if you have an issue with drugs or alcohol and you're a true addict, you often have a dual diagnosis. So you may have depression, you may have PTSD, you may have some kind of diagnosis. Mm-hmm. You might be bipolar, whatever. And it was a program that was very intensive to help people understand their programs, but not only deal with their addiction, but with what other issues they may have. And sometimes you would be court-ordered into this program.
Okay.
And sometimes you would come voluntarily. And it was felt that there was a big need to help women and children, and that's what I did.
And how successful do you think the program was?
I think very successful. Very
nice.
Successful.
Because
it's still ongoing. It's still here in Utah.
Nice. Yeah, you laid out the landscape very well of drug addiction, substance dependency,
yeah,
combined with secondary issues that may be the primary issues And so if you could get
sometimes through to that. For women, they may have been abused as children.
Yep.
They may have been in an abusive relationship. Sometimes those issues existed.
Yep. Yep.
So.
And that's a lot of, again, psychological counseling, to get people to discover their own self-worth.
Well, and also with the Women and Children's Program, we were working on developing healthy family relationships and how to be a helpful, you know, a healthy parent.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And have healthy children.
Which then goes off to, you know, be a job.
Right.
I mean, just so many different. You got to be financially dependent, and you have to be able to spend time with your children. And if there's a single family, single parent.
Yeah.
Thank you. Kind of household is very, very difficult to manage all that.
Yes, and I can imagine it's even harder nowadays. So remember, this is back in the 90s.
No, I think this is it's been difficult throughout our time as a species on this planet. Raising a family without two parents is a challenge. It's an absolute challenge. So this is 1994. What were some of the difficulties you faced in the Odyssey House, and how did you deal with those?
Well, I think it was just one thing I learned very strongly when I was at Odyssey House was how to deal with confrontation in a healthy way. So that not only was I helping women who were mothers deal with their issues, I was learning how to react in a positive, in a helpful way and deal with my own actions in a way that was helpful. So that was very helpful. I don't know if I'm making myself very clear there, but I found that to be very helpful for myself so that I could stay balanced and in tune and not overstep my bounds. Because when you're director of a program or in charge of something, if you're not careful, you can become the ultimate voice and power involved in something. And that doesn't work, and that's not healthy in working with people. You have to be open and understand your own self and what you're doing in order to help other people.
Right. And I would think that your staff, when I think of confrontation, I think of two people and an issue. And the clients, if I can use that word, that you're dealing with, single mothers and their children, and they have issues. And so that your employees, your social workers, have to confront those issues without making it personal and seem like a personal attack.
Well, also, and then, of course, they could, the clients or your staff could also bring issues up to those in charge of a program and say, why are you doing this? Or why did you say this? Or why don't we do this?
Right.
Or
right.
Why don't we change this? Or why do we have this policy? And you need to, and I learned, that was one of the things that was very helpful for me at Odyssey House, was how to learn to deal with that in a way that was helpful rather than making myself the grand poopa on top of the pedestal, if you know what
right,
I'm trying
right.
to say.
Right, we're going to do this because it's my way or the highway.
Uh-huh.
It's a matter of stepping back from that. But it requires more effort on your part to say, well, you know, we have this policy in place because XYZ happened, or, you know, we are legally mandated, or, you know, for any number of reasons.
And that was also part of the Odyssey model of doing their program.
How so?
That was also part, being able to deal with confrontation and do it in a positive way was part of the model of Odyssey House as their program, in their program.
And I would assume that had the potential to deal with the burnout as well.
I think so. I don't think I felt as much burnout with Odyssey House as I did with working with homeless people.
Okay. Okay. And how long were you there?
I was there until 96 when I decided to retire, and I then did some humanitarian service work for my church, and I ended up in Vietnam.
Oh. Well, I'm glad I asked. Well, let's take it step by step. I'm without being too direct here, how old were you in 1986? I guess that's a direct question.
I was in 1986. Sorry, well, I was born in 33. You do the math. All right,
so 43, 53, 63, 73, 83, 93. So you would have been 63 in 1996. Was there any precipitating incident why you decided that you wanted to retire, or was it just it was up and running and you'd done your work and it was a good time to step out?
I just felt it was the time to step out. Okay. And also felt it was a good time to let my own family be more independent. So I sort of thought if I were out of the picture, that would help.
Okay.
But I just felt it was the right thing to do. And so I went through the process of application to do some humanitarian service work and was supposed to go to India and had a fellow, another woman, who was going to go with me. And we had done all the paperwork. I'd done all the research. I'd done this, that, and the other. I'd even put my house up for sale, because I felt like I had a home in the avenues of Salt Lake City that had been restored, and I felt like I couldn't leave it with renters, that they would destroy it. It would be better just to sell it. And the paperwork came back from India, thanks, no thanks, because you don't have PhD in mental retardation. Well, I don't know there's such a PhD that exists, but the woman that was going to go with me did have a PhD in education. And I, of course, had my master's degree in social work with LCSW licensure, so that I had mental health diagnostic qualifications. But it ended up that it was changed, and we went to Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam, where we taught English.
When did you go to Ho Chi Minh City?
In the fall of 96.
And did you sell your house?
Yes.
Wow.
Had people fighting over it.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Was this the first time you had been out of the country?
Yes, yes.
So,
but fortunately, before we went, we had a two-month training program to help us understand how to teach English as a second language, and also some beginning training in Vietnamese language.
Oh, great, great. Was it easy for you to learn Vietnamese? Were you good at picking up languages?
Well, we didn't really have long enough. I will just say I've probably forgotten most of it now, but I could speak en peu, that's French, for a little.
Okay.
So we learned some basic things, some counting, some basic phrases, like thank you, goodbye, numbers, basic things like that. Vietnamese language has five tones, and so it's a rather musical language, and it also has a Latin alphabet, so you could see a word written, but depending on the marks for the tone, it could have different meanings.
Okay.
So I found it difficult to learn Vietnamese and teach English at the same time.
I bet.
Somehow I couldn't make that work.
Wow. Yeah, and were you, what age were you teaching? What age group?
We were assigned to an educational facility in Ho Chi Minh City. So some of my students were like the director of this program,
okay.
a highly educated man on the social cultural committee of Ho Chi Minh City, which is a communist thing. So I had doctoral students, master's students who were doing their research in some of them in literature, music, the social or the economic structure of their country. So these were adults,
so,
and also some of the staff of the institute. I had the electrician in my beginning class. I had one of the maids who worked there in my beginning class. So it was a cross-section.
Okay, but adults.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And what were your first thoughts on arrival at Ho Chi Minh City?
Huh. Well, I was surprised at the uniforms, and they were carrying guns, like going through customs. That was a surprise to me. I remember when we arrived in Ho Chi Minh City at the airport, going through customs to go in, you know, to go on our way. I had to lift up my own suitcases. It seemed to be in Asia or in Southeast Asia that women are considered to be very strong and you take care of yourself. So I learned very fast that I had to carry my own things. I had a lot of steps to climb, and I was just expected to be a strong woman. But at the airport, as I lifted my big suitcase up there, she asked me how many kilos of something I had. And I looked at her, and I said, I don't know what's a kilo. She just looked at me and passed me through.
Oh, my gosh. Uh-huh.
Which I must have been lucky. I've since learned that a kilo was a 2-point-something pound.
Right. Right. And again, you know, you're in your 60s, and you haven't been weightlifting, I can imagine.
No.
So suddenly it's like, oh, gee, I packed too much.
Well, we followed our guidelines. So, of course, for international travel, you could only have so much anyway. But
oh, good. They were thinking ahead.
Anyway, I did it. So I got used to rain and stairs and carrying things. I called it the land of the free sauna. But I found the people to be very kind and very respectful. They're very respectful of their elders. And, of course, now that I'm 87, I don't think 63 or 64 is being old. But
right, right.
but they looked at me as, and I was, they also had great respect for professors. And so even though I was teaching English as a second language, I was considered a professor.
Mm-hmm. How long were you there?
We were there about 18 months, came home in March of 98.
What are some of the things you remember from your time there?
Well, gee whiz, do you have a few hours?
Well, I certainly have some time.
No, I'm just joking. Well, I remember how kind people were and how eager they were to learn English, and of course, they were basically, in a sense, required to learn English. It was becoming the language of the world for business,
mm-hmm.
And so forth. So, but they were very hospitable and very kind. For example, my birthday would have been in July. We had been studying in our English class a lot, and of course these are all Western English materials. They'd either be British out of the land, out of England, or
mm-hmm.
out of the United States. So a lot of the vocabulary and so on we would be teaching would be based on Western ideas, and they'd learned about birthday parties. So they decided to give me a birthday party. And there was this great big cake. Of course, I don't know if you know that at one time the French ruled Vietnam for over 200 years. So mm-hmm. there were French bakeries in Ho Chi Minh City. There was this huge, beautiful birthday cake. But every one of my students, and I had two levels. I had beginning and a more advanced level. Every one of my students came to this birthday party, and every single one of them brought me a gift.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
I have never had such a lovely birthday party in my whole life.
Wow.
And I still have things in my home from that birthday party. You know, some pottery or some
That's beautiful.
Typical Vietnamese, so on and so forth. And even one man who I know had a very limited income brought me a packet of postcards.
Oh.
I just remember how kind, how gentle they were, and how helpful they would be. But also, the Vietnamese like to sing. We were always singing, and of course we'd have to sing in English because we were teaching English. So one of their favorite songs was "You Are My Sunshine."
Nice. I would imagine that would have been lovely because you like to sing too.
Well, but I'm not a soloist. Sometimes I would be asked to sing.
Well, you could start the first few bars and then the first few lines and then ask others to join in.
Well, I used to sing a song called Little Purple Pansies. I don't know if you even know what that was. It was a song from my childhood.
I don't. So. Nice. Yeah, fun. I would assume that there were some indicators of the Vietnam War with the United States.
Oh yes. Yeah.
But it sounds like the Vietnamese had moved on. They had.
Well, actually, in a way, that was still there because even though I was there teaching English and they were very appreciative and very respectful of me and very kind to me, on some level, I was the enemy.
Okay.
So. I was not treated as the enemy, but as far, and I'm talking about society in general, on some level I was the tyrant. I'm not personally, but I represented that phase of their life.
And so it makes me think, knowing a little bit now about you in this fourth oral history we're doing, that you would have been a wonderful ambassador to show a different side of America that the Vietnamese, of course, in conflict, would never see.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. I really had a wonderful time there, and they were very kind to us. And they would take us touring. So I got to see many parts of Vietnam that some people might not see. I've been to most of southern Vietnam. I've also been to Hanoi, their capital. I've seen some of their cultural sites. So it was almost like being on a grand vacation, although it wasn't really a vacation.
Mm-hmm. It was a working vacation.
It was a working vacation.
Yeah. Nice.
And some of those friendships I've considered went on for years and years. Probably until about 5 years ago, I was in touch with people I knew in Ho Chi Minh City.
Nice. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's. I think that's wonderful diplomacy.
In fact, at one time, the director of the program where we taught and one of his associates came to Utah, to the University of Utah, to do some research and so on, and I was able to host them in my home.
Nice. So returning some of the favors.
Yes. That was a special experience. So.
It's funny. It seems like when we leave the country, we get exposed to other people's a sense of how to work with the stranger. And that,
well, that's true. And of course, we're all human beings, and actually, we're all kind of the same. I have a biracial grandson, and he used to say, if I unzip my skin, we're all the same.
That's right. Yep. Yeah. But hospitality, sometimes we learn much more about hospitality by traveling to get a sense to see, when hospitality becomes embarrassing, it's like, oh my gosh, I never dreamt that that could be hospitality. Hey, you like this picture on the wall? Take it.
I'm like,
wait, this is your house and you have nothing in your house. And how can you even think to give me something because you have nothing?
They were very generous, very, very kind and very generous.
Nice. And so I would assume that within 18 months, you probably got better at teaching English than when you started.
Oh, yes. And I was re-educated in a sense to learning out the rules we have in English. English is really a difficult language.
Yes.
In many ways, at least for other people. However, the Vietnamese are very good because not only were they have their native language, which could change a little bit from, they would say they had high Vietnamese or low Vietnamese, or which part of the country they lived in, you might have a little different emphasis on some parts of their language. But also were they learning English. Some of them knew Russian from the pre-strong communist time. Uh-huh. A lot of them knew Chinese.
Okay.
So they were often not only bilingual, trilingual, and more than that.
Multilingual, yeah.
It was amazing to me.
Nice. Well, yeah, there's people that are good with languages all around the world. It's a skill that some people have. Just,
of course, they're very disciplined people. Asians are very disciplined.
Okay. So on your return in March of 1988,
1998.
Sorry, 1998. Thank you. You had sold your house, left the country with a couple suitcases, and now you were coming back with a couple suitcases and a lot of gifts.
yes. Well, and, well, my basic furnishings had been in storage, as had been my automobile.
Okay.
So I did rent an apartment for a while, and then I purchased a home in a community called Sandy, Utah.
Oh, okay.
And so just reestablished a household, reconnected with family, grandchildren, children. But the social work part of me was still there.
Mm-hmm.
So I did some volunteer work with the foster board with Child Protective Services in Utah for a while. Did some work for Salt Lake County Aging, where I had a hospice assignment where I would visit people on hospice.
Okay.
And then further on, after the hospice, just went into helping with Salt Lake County Aging, just had some clients who I would help on a weekly basis, and we'd go to the library, to the grocery store, or whatever, and made some very dear friends in doing that. And continued that until about maybe 7 years ago.
Okay, to 2013 or so? 2014?
Probably. I'm just guessing.
Nice.
So now I'm just in my little old lady house in a planned community in a home that doesn't have a single stair.
Good for you. Yes, yeah, we learn eventually, all right, no more stairs, I'm done.
Yeah.
Now at this young age that you find yourself, looking back in a fairly beautiful rear view mirror, Is there anything else you'd like to say to anyone who might hear this interview 50 years from now?
Oh, my. Perhaps I'm very grateful for the many opportunities that come to me. I'm very grateful for my husband's career in the National Park Service. It took me out of my very conservative upbringing and helped introduce me into many different places and many different people, a cross-section of humanity. I think it has helped me be a better person. And I also have come out of that in great amazement at the wonder of this world. You know, we really have a beautiful world, and I've lived in some beautiful places like Yosemite, Rocky Mountain National Park, and the Grand Canyon, of course, and Mount Rainier, but also in some big cities. And I think I would just say, trust humanity. People are wonderful.
Nice.
But while you're at it, take time to smell the air and watch the birds and smell the flowers.
That's really nice. Well, maybe this is a good place to wrap up this oral history. What do you think?
Well, I'm not sure I have anything more to say.
Well, this has been lovely, Donna. I'm so thankful and appreciative of you taking the time to participate in this program and share your beautiful life, your time with your husband and your children, and your service to humanity. I'm very grateful for that.
Well, thank you. It's been good for me to remember.
Wonderful. Well, with that, this will conclude part four of a Grand Canyon Oral History with Donna Gebler. Today is April 26th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin, and Donna, thank you so very, very much.
You're welcome. Thank you. You've been a gracious host.
You're very kind.